So,
yeah.
Sandra. Ta question.
I am new to the Dharma and I would like to know why it is important to have a master.
First of all, I must say that I'm very happy to see all of you again. And I'm very happy that many of you have also joined from last year. And I also am very happy that some new people have also joined, you know, just beginning. And sometimes it is not easy to join in to a class which has been going on for a couple of years. But sometimes it is also easier, you know, because everybody, you can learn from everybody. So that way can be... like when I was, when I first went to the Yong Lama's home school, there were like 25 Tulkus, and the eldest was maybe around 35, and the youngest was 9, that was me. And it was the same class. You know, it was very nice because everybody was nice and kind, you know. So I could ask anything, you know, the silliest questions, nobody would bother. it was nice. Anyway, you know, the Dharma I think it is like this, you know, Dharma is Dharma is I think is a training. You know, it's a kind of a, it's a learning process. It's a training on how to if you want to say this, you can say this, I think. The Buddhist would say this. Some people don't like this way of saying, you know, how to be happy. It's a training on how to be happy. And when you say happy, it's not just like excited. It's how to find kind of peace within yourself, and joy within yourself. You know, how to be yourself in a way. But it is, you know, it's a practical thing. You know, it's not just an intellectual, you know, intellectual way of learning. There is some intellectual things also, understanding and things like that, more practical, you know. I always think that it is a little bit like, you know, learning how to drive a car, or how to play some music or something like that, which you have to learn, you know, which is something that you have to learn. But you cannot learn unless there is somebody to teach you. Although nobody can really teach you, you know, it's a. I always, maybe you have listened to this story many times, but I used to, you know, I learned how to drive car, you know, in America. Because I'm sure all of you have driver license, but if you don't have, America is the best place to do it. Because, you know, you just go and, you know, get your, you know, what you call it, the, just read the book and then, you know, you just give the, what you call it, that little test, very simple, and then you can just drive, you know, you can go on the highway. Only thing is you have to have somebody who knows how to drive with you. You don't have to give, you don't have to pay anybody, because in Europe it's very costly, you know, nothing, you can drive. And then you can give exams, you know, tests, anytime you like. The restriction is that you cannot give more than once a day. And they're very lenient also. Anyway, I will not tell the whole story, but so I had lots of teachers, you know, on how to drive. There were, you know, there were Norwegians, there were Irish people, there were Germans, there was Americans, and, you know, Belgians, and English, and there was even one who was training people how to fly jets. But then, you know, I didn't do very well because I was not, you know, I was not hardworking enough, you know. So I failed when I first went for the test. There's a long and very funny story how I failed, but I will not tell that. So, you know, it's like there is, you know, you really have to have somebody to tell you, you know, how to do things. Although, intellectually, you know it very easily, you know, like this is clutch. But then when you actually do it, it is totally different, you know. But then it is something that really you have to learn. You know, nobody can really, you know, you need somebody to teach you, but, and this one who teach you has to know exactly how to do it. You know, it's not somebody, you know, who, like somebody who knows the theory only cannot teach you. But it has to be somebody who really knows how to do it. But then you cannot really be taught, you know, like you cannot just say, give a lesson and then finished, you know. You have to. So it's, I think, a little bit like that. You know, it's a, and it's all, anything you learn is a little bit like that. You need to learn from a person who has the experience. Mm-hmm. But then, it's not only that, you know. One needs to learn and one needs to, you know, all many different things together. So therefore, sometimes, you know, people think that, oh, I have a master finished. You know? My master is His Holiness the Dalai Lama. You know, there are many people like that. Okay, in a way, it's very nice. I mean, it's your devotion and, you know, like that. But then, you know, that's also, you know, there has to be learning, there has to be teaching, there has to be, you know, it's all together. So it's sometimes I think, you know, it's you have to have a master. That's, you know, the whole process, you know, whole kind of emphasis on that. That is also not the case. It's not just about the master, because sometimes I meet people say, when do I meet my master? You know, I've been waiting for him for last 20 years. You know, it's not like that. You know, you can learn from anybody and everywhere. It's not just that you have to wait for your master to appear, you know, like then there's somebody coming and then the thundering and, you know, rain of flowers and things like that. Nothing necessary like that. But, you know, so we have to learn from everybody, I think, you know. And we have to learn from everybody and anybody. Like Patrick Rinpoche says, you know, that if we need, you know, we need to learn from anybody and everybody. That anything that anybody has got something to teach us, we must learn. He says, like the like the duck takes the milk from the water. You know this. You know how they do it. You don't know how they do it. You put some milk in water and put it in front of a duck. And then the duck will put her beak in the water, and after a few minutes, all the milk will be taken out. The water will be clean. And this can be done by the tortoise also. Tortoise. You know, some little tortoise can also like that. So, what he means to say is that, you know, your teacher or whoever does not need to be necessarily, I mean it's better if he or she is perfect, but does not need to be completely 100% perfect. If they have something to teach you, then you should learn it. He even said that even if somebody who is a completely like a drunkard and, you know, completely useless fellow has something important to teach you, you must learn that. So that's, I think, the understanding. And also in Buddhism we talk about Gampopa says about it a lot, and I think it's everywhere else. We have this different kind of teachers, you know, like masters, Buddhas, you know, as our masters or teachers. Then bodhisattvas of different bhumis, you know, very realized ones. Then sosyusewo, you know what sosyusewo is? Samsarik, you know, just completely samsarik, like us. Like, I don't know what to you, but and then, you know, the samsarik teachers, or he says, is very important because, you know, it's like it's very difficult to find, you know, the great realized teachers. And even if there are, because we are not realized, so we don't necessarily realize how realized we are. So, you know, the samsaric teachers are also very important. So that's how it is said. Maybe I shouldn't go too long because then we will not finish. Okay. Next one is Mimi. Well, I think I can just. Or you have something more to say? Well, yes, you want to know about. Do you have a story which can help us see how study, reflection and meditation can remove doubts of the nature of reality for good? Story. Story, I don't remember any story, specific story, but generally, you know, the story of any great master is a story of this. If you kind of read the story of any great master, like including Patu Rinpoche or Mepam Rinpoche, or Mepam Rinpoche didn't have to study too much. He didn't have to study too much, you know. He said, but he still did. You know, he still did. He said that anything that he read once, he understood completely. So, and also memorized completely. So, he didn't have to do much. Only this the logic in this, what you call it, Sema. He said he had some difficulties. You know. He read it and he had little difficulties. Then he was very disappointed, you know, because he didn't understand the first time. So he, you know, he kind of made lots of, you know, supplications to Manjushri and things like that. Then he went to sleep. In the dream, he saw Sakya Pandita. And then Sakya Pandita said, you know, he had this book of the Thema, the Pramana, you know. And then he said, oh, this is very easy, there's nothing there, you know. It's just Gaya, you know, Ga means, Ga is what? Negate. And Ya is what? Establish. Establish and negate. And then he, you know, he kind of cut this book into two pieces and gave him and said, put it together. So Mevalambhuja took it and put it together, and then it went one, you know, it just like one went one whole one. And then when he woke up in the morning, he understood everything. So it was very, very easy for him. But still, he did receive lots of teachings. He went all over the, you know, Tibet to receive teachings. He was also in Sarandipung Garden, you know, and things like that. And, you know, he did study. But generally, it's like that. I mean, the of course, there are certain, you know, different kind of people. You know, some people who are said to be more what they call as the Chikcharwa, and then Rinchipa. You know, Chikcharwa is what do you call it? Yeah, instantaneous or spontaneous, you know, like, you know, you give an empowerment and then, you know, or give one, you know, kind of one instruction by a great master and then you get it and you understand it and, you know everything, you know, like, not the details maybe, but, you know, the main thing. But even those kind of people, then, you know, in order to teach others, you know, later on study, like Khenpo Ngakchung. You know Khenpo Ngakchung? Khenpo Ngakchung was a student of Nyoshi Longtok. And then Nyoshi Longtok was the student of Pathu Rinpoche. So Khenpo Ngakchung, at a very early age, he came to see Nyoshi Longtok. And Nyoshi Longtok gave him all the Dzogchen teachings, practice, you know. Practice instructions and things like that, and then he became very good at it. You know, he realized the nature of mind, and, you know, he became a very good, you know, master. But then, after he became like that, then one day Nyoshi Longtok said, "Now you should go to the Seda. Now you should go to the Seda." So he sent him to Dzogchen, to Seda, right from the beginning, to study, you know, Kenjuk and Omarajuk. So he studied, and then he became a scholar, you know, and then he became a great master later on. Of course, it became very easy because he understood the, you know, so it was a little bit like the opposite way, you know. But usually, it is first we study, because then study means like listening to the teachings. Study means like reading the books. Study means, you know, receiving the teachings, you know, through different ways to understand, getting the understanding. That's the study. If you don't study, or if you don't have any instructions, if you don't know anything, you know, then, you know, it's difficult to practice. How to practice? We don't know how to practice. So therefore, in order to practice, we need to know how to practice. If we didn't know how to practice, we cannot practice. No? So therefore, it is important to know how to practice. Therefore, study is on how to practice. So therefore study actually means learning how to practice. But then, you know, when you study, you know, it's not just that you only listen. You know. Listening is important. This is very important from Buddhist point of view, you know, like in this kind of step by step, that first you listen, you know, you don't ask questions. You can ask questions, but you know, it's not like what can you say? It's not that you already make a decision on what, you know, what is all about, even before you have, you know, time to listen from beginning to end, you know. Then you never know what somebody is saying, you know. So therefore try to listen carefully and try to get the instructions or ideas or understandings or, you know, of others or of the teachers or of the, you know, the person you are studying before you put your own opinion about that. You know, that's the whole point. Because we have this tendency to, you know, to come to a conclusion before we actually, you know, listen. I think that's not only in study, but that's in our general communication also, you know. Most of the time we don't listen, you know, before somebody finishes saying what they want to say, we already have replied. You know. So this makes lots of problems, you know, in the relationships and in the communication. So the listening, the study is a little bit like that. The first, to really try to understand what the people are saying. That's the first thing. After you understand exactly what they are saying, then you reflect. That's the idea. It's not that you accept everything what anybody says, but you first really understand what they are saying, you know. Then you reflect. You can reflect as much as you like. You can ask as much as questions you like. You can, you know, you can debate on it. You can, you know, you need to do this. This is the main understanding from Buddhist point of view, because, you know, it is very bad just to accept, you know, even if it is said by the Buddha, because then you don't understand, you just believe. And there is no, it's not enough just to believe, because, you know, I just said this, you know, to Dharma is not just believing, it's transforming, it's for a transformation, it's for, you know, learning deeply. So therefore believing is not enough. So therefore we need to really deeply ask questions. You know, it's not necessary that, oh, you know, we kind of I'm in front of this Lama, I'm studying this, so, you know, I have to assume that it is right. Yeah, nothing like that. You know, you can ask questions or debate against Buddha's sayings, Nagarjuna's, you know, Mipha Rinpoche, whoever they may be, you know. There is nothing called blasphemy in Buddhism. You know, there is no word. Blasphemy is not there. You can say whatever you like. Sometimes, you know, you when you look in the debates, you get shocked, you know, how how badly they talk to each other, you know. But then they at the same time they do lots of respect, but they say bad things, you know. So there is nothing like that. So you can really ask, you know, really hurting questions to anybody, you know, including the Buddha. You know? Because it's about your understanding, you know, you need to really understand it fully, not just believing. But then, even if you intellectually know everything, you have no doubt about everything, that's not enough. You know? We have to practice it. Practice means that what we understand, we need to learn how to react in that way, how to live in that. You know, it's not just, you know, like if you say, okay, it's nice, it's very good to be compassionate, that's, you know, it's rather easy to understand. But then, you know, when something happens a little bit, you know, then you get red and blue and, you know, you know, what you call it, coming fire out of your, you know, also from here. You know, this so the practice, you know, the practice is really, through that understanding that you know deeply that this is the way this is the best way to react, there's no other way. You know? This is, if I react in this way, that's not good for me, that's not good for others, there's no use, there's no use reacting like that. The only way that is good for me and others is to react in this way. You know, to understand that deeply is the what reflection comes to. But then, habitually we don't react like this, so we immediately react the other way. You know, and then, if we are not careful, we have lots of excuses, you know, you know, to make us kind of, I cannot do this because it's not like this. You know, I try to be very nice to him, but you know, and then you know, so then that understanding was not like, you know, really practical or practice enough. So you know, so that's when you need, you know, like to remind yourself. And practice is almost, you know, like actually reminding yourself again and again, and you know, trying to live by way that you really learned how to do it. You know, so because of these three, you know, these three stages, so these three things are very interrelated, you know, and that's how to practice. You know, how to practice Dharma is this, through study, through reflection, and through practice. And because of that, you know, then these three things becomes very important. Sometimes people say, I just meditate, I just practice. But then, how do you meditate, you know? It's not enough just to close your eyes and sit down, you know. You have to learn exactly how to do it. And, you know, there are many stages and many ways and many, you know, subtle things that you have to learn. You know, so you really have to learn deeply, you know. It's not just sitting and, you know, the sitting is very important, but you know, so the all other things, you know, the understandings behind it, and you know, your attitude and way of seeing things, and you know, so many things. So that's why, you know, that's it. And how do I know that that I have Buddha nature? Well. Generally, it is said like this. What is Buddha? I'm asking you.
Awake.
Awake like what? I awoke also this morning. I'm not completely asleep even now.
Omniscience.
Buddha is omniscience.
Buddhahood is omniscience.
Buddhahood is omniscience. And? Just that?
Completely awakened from ignorance, having removed all the obscurations, and as a result, opened up into this omniscience, knowing the nature of things and all that.
Okay. When we, you know, when we talk of the Buddha's qualities, you know, we talk about Chen Zhe Nusu, in Chen Zhe Nusu. You know, Chen Zhe Chen, you know, Tibetan. You're all studying Tibetan, no? Or not?
Yes, we're
yes. Chen is knowing. Zhe is loving, you know, compassion, love. Nu is like ability, capacity, you know, kind of power. We always talk about Chenzi Nusu. But generally speaking, you know, when we talk about the Buddha's qualities, the Buddha's mind, two things most important. They said that somebody who has developed, you can call it, awakened, you can call it, you know, aroused, you can call it, you know, awakened, you can call it, whatever, but, you know, one's compassion and wisdom. We say like that. Somebody who has, you know, developed his or her wisdom and compassion to the utmost. That's a Buddha. That's how it is usually described in the easiest way. You know, Buddha is somebody who has blossomed, or, you know, that's why we call Sangha wisdom and compassion. Now, wisdom is omniscience, you can say, but wisdom is also, you know, the omniscience can be of two kinds, knowing about everything, but knowing the nature of everything, you know. It's citta vanchenpa, jinye panchenpa, you know, we have to, one is to know the details of the nature, you know, details of everything, and one is to know the nature of everything, you know. And sometimes they say to know the nature of everything is more important, because then by knowing one, you know everything. So that wisdom is that, knowing the nature of everything. But another most important thing is the compassion, you know, this unlimited compassion. So a Buddha has to be these two, you know, has to have these two. So now, to see whether I have the Buddha nature or not, is to see whether I have a little bit of this too or not. You know, something that can be, you know, like a seedling, or like, a, you know, a little bit of a knowledge, or capacity to learn, or capacity to understand, and capacity to love. If I have that, then I have Buddha nature. Yeah? But then, of course, I mean, that's from the logical point of view, that's how to say it. But then, it is also that if you really look at your mind, and, you know, that's another matter, that's another matter. That it's... anyway, that's enough, I think. Then, Sarah.
Yeah. This question is really, it's arisen because we've been studying again with Nikam Rinpoche, and he keeps saying we must develop certainty, and the certainty will be based on reasoning. And the problem that I've had for some time is that with the inference, it seems that it's actually based on an assumption that nature is uniform, and so it's not actually based on reasoning. So it's quite difficult to sort of develop the certainty based on this reasoning when there doesn't seem to be any reasoning there. So that's the question as it's written is, is it then correct to describe inference as valid proof as it is based on an assumption that nature behaves in a uniform way?
A actually, certainty is only from the experience. You know? I mean, it's like you know, like if I actually see it, you know, if I see and touch and taste and, you know, then I'm in, and then I make sure that I'm not asleep, and you know, that then, you know, then I'm, the more I kind of I'm certain or convinced of, you know, the actual, you know, my own, you know, eyes and ears and, you know, mouth and taste and everything, that I'm, then I see it, you know, my own experience, you can call it experience, that's the only way to ascertain, no? But my own experience can also be sometimes wrong, no? So therefore, there is, you know, the usually, I mean, that you know, if I see myself and then if I kind of, you know, try to, with all my possible way, possible faculties, you know, that I understand clearly, and then I say this is it, that's the truth, you know. So all, you know, all the inferences are also based on something like that. You know, it's not, you cannot base an inference on something that is not directly experienced. That you have kind of, you know it is true through your own experience or through some very reliable way, you know, whatever possible reliable way, and that reliability you have confirmed through, you know, many different ways. You know, that's the inference. You know, inference is to say like you see something and then you say, I see this, can you also see this? You know, sometimes I say, and they say, yes, I see this also. And then, you know, then you, can you also see this? Yes, you can also see this. And they, is it the same thing that we see? Yes, we all see same thing. So then it must be correct. Then you say, okay, now it's really like that. You know? Now, because I can, you know, ascertain or get some certainty about that, now, you know, because everything that is, what can you say, everything that's true is also you cannot see, you know? There's lots of things you cannot directly see, you know, like you have to get some information through some, you know, way, like if somebody says that, oh, you know, there's a stupa in Bodha, you know, and you know, if you can go and then see the stupa, yes, now I see the stupa in, and then somebody comes and says there's another stupa in Swayambhu, and then I say, is it, you know, is it really true? There's a stupa in Swayambhu. And then somebody takes a photograph and says, oh yes, maybe it's true, you know. Something like that, you know. Then, but then after the same person whom you have been with, you know, and things like that, and then they said that, okay, there's a cave in Asura. You know, and then kind of, if you knew that this person very well, and you know, all the other things, then you, okay, there's the most probably is a cave in Asura, because, you know, so, you know, we kind of come to conclusions with many other, you know, those that not necessarily that we, you know, we myself, but direct contact, but through different means, you know, like usually what example we give to inference is like, you know, we see whenever we make a fire, there's a smoke, you know, not all the time, but you know, when there's a smoke, then there has to be something like a fire. Or we know that through our experience. So then when we see a smoke, even if we don't see the fire, we kind of know, you know, some kind of fire is there because there's smoke, you know, unless it is cloud. And then we have to see whether it's not cloud, you know. So this is, you know, the inference. Inference is based on experience. It's not just, you know, when you say reason, reason is not like something different from experience. Reason is our own experience. You know, reason is our own experience, and you know, our own knowledge, and you know, that because it is like that, because the smoke. There is no smoke without a fire because we have seen it many times. So therefore, you know, if there is a smoke, there has to be something like burning or something like that. Some kind of fire has to be there. So we know, you know. So these kind of, you know, that's the, you know, the reasoning is through that way. And then we have to also see that there is, you know, the reasoning has to be that when you make a reason, you never, like when there is a smoke, there is fire. Now you have to be very clear through your experience that there's never been any smoke without a fire or some kind of fire. You know, this you have to establish. If you didn't establish that, then that's not good reasoning, you know. So therefore, you know, inference is a. Did you study this? You know, these three things. You know, chusum. Yeah. So chusum, you know, it has to have this chusum. I don't know what to call chusum. Three criteria. So therefore, because you know it can be wrong reasoning, you know, it can be wrong reasoning, and if you make the wrong reasoning, then it doesn't correspond to the experience. So the reasoning has to be according to the right reasoning way, you know, so that you are really sure that it is like that. So therefore, you know, but then. Certainty, you know, like in that's why, you know, the reflection is important. You know, reflection is to make the certainty experientially, not intellectually at least. But then it has to become also experientially certain, you know, like through your own experience, through meditation and things like that, you know. The more you actually experience, the more certain you become. Otherwise, you cannot be 100% certain. You know? Like certainty that we talk about in the nature of the, you know, realization and things like that, you know, the way you are. That only through reasoning you can be 100% certain. You know, 100% certain cannot be just through reasoning. It has to be through experience. And so therefore, you know, that's why also study, reflection and meditation, you know, these three things. Meditation is actually experiencing, you know. And although people, you know, we said that, you know, there should be certainty about everything, but I think it is not possible to have 100% certainty unless you really have the realization, you know. It's not, you know, that's why, you know, Nagarjuna said that even if you have a little bit of doubt about the nature of, you know, like emptiness and nature of things, it actually helps a lot, you know. It's not that, you know, the certainty is not easy. Certainty is certainty has to be really completely experienced, and that doesn't come unless you have that, you know, meditatively or experientially certain. But through understanding, through study, through reflection, if you have a more positive doubt, that is enough to, you know, to shake the samsara, he says. You know. So this is that's important. Then, Melanie?
I would like to know if you can explain the link between the matter and the mind.
Matter and the mind. Mind linked to our body. Clear explanation in the Tantra, can you explain? Now this is mind and matter. Mind linked to our body, that's another thing. And mind and matter may be a little bit different. Mind and body. You know, I think we have to understand it like this. Sometimes we say that there's nothing that's not the mind. And this is not only citta matra, you know. It's not only citta matra. Mihoru Rinpoche said it very clearly that, you know, this everything is mind. Is not just citta matra. Now when you say that, then again sometimes, you know, people think that, well, if that is like that, then, you know, you are my mind, you know. So I go out of this room and you all disappear. Is it like that, you know? I think it's not like that. It's not necessarily like that. I think this is my understanding. It could be totally wrong, you know. I think it is like this, that you know, whatever I experience, it cannot be outside the scope of my mind. You know, whether I experience matter, whether I experience person, whether I experience, you know, whatever I experience, it has to be my experience. Otherwise, I cannot experience, you know. Isn't it? I cannot see, I cannot hear, I cannot experience anything unless I experience. So it's my mind, you know. It has to be within the scope of my mind that I experience. If my mind is not experiencing or not seeing you, then I wouldn't see. And the way I see you is the way I experience, you know, through my mind. You know, the way I experience the whole world is it could be, it's because of the way I am, it's because the way I am, you know, my mind is structured or, you know, kind of developed, the way my body is also, you know, if I am not the way I am now, with this body mind, whatever way I am constructed, you know, if I don't have this kind of eye, if I don't have this kind of brain, if I don't have this kind of, you know, physical and mental and psychological structure, I wouldn't experience the way I do now, you know. So therefore, you know, the way the whole world is for me has a lot to do with the way I am. You know? The same is with everybody. You know? Same is with everybody. You know? Now, we usually say that this is my mind and this is the wall. You know? This wall is nothing to do with my mind. Usually think, you know. This wall is there if I'm not there. You know, this wall is there if all of us are not there. You know, this wall is independent of the way we are. But actually it's not completely true. The way that we see this world is the way we are. We are similar in many ways. That's why we call it, you know, we call it what? Common karma. From Buddhist terms, what we call common karma is that we are all in the same way. We have two eyes, you know. We have the same kind of, you know, little bit different, but same kind of brain, and same kind of, you know, eye functions, you know, same. If I, my eye is not like, you know, X-ray, or not like, you know, totally different, then I wouldn't see this wall, no? I could see through this wall. So therefore, you know, the way I see this world is not because the world is exactly like this, because I am like that. If there was somebody who was totally different from me, they wouldn't, you know, the wall would be different, you know, for them. Maybe there will be no wall for them, you know, or it will be something totally different. So therefore, you know, me and my world has, you know, my mind, you can call it my mind, because experience is called mind in, you know, Buddhism, has lots of connections, you know. So therefore, in one way, you know, in a deeper way, I cannot really establish my world without my mind, you know, because it's my experience. If I say this is a good world, it's my experience. It's a nasty world, it's my experience, you know. If I say world is totally empty or emptiness, that's also my mind saying, or it's really completely there, that's also, you know, the way I, you know, I see the world, I see the people, is very much to do with, you know, how I am and how I react and things like that. So therefore, you know, mind and matter is, you know, the way my mind is, the way I, you know, am, and then way the things are, is, you know, is not, is very difficult at that level to, you know, say that this is matter and, you know, something else, and this is mind and something else. It's from if you look from the experience point of view, you know, usually we are, you know, we are always used to look from the matter point of view, you know. This is mind, you know, like even if when I look and I investigate, or if I scientifically look at something, then this is like this, you know. Mind is just a matter or product of a matter or something like that. But then we forget that who is actually saying that. You know, it's our mind who is saying that. You know, if I said that the mind is useless, it's just a product of a matter. If you say that, who is saying that? You know, it's the mind who is saying that. You know, so therefore, you know, sometimes we kind of, you know, we make the matter so concrete that we forget that how we, you know, the kind of thing or that categorizes like that is actually our mind. So therefore, you know, the mind, I think it's very difficult to, whatever way we look at or whatever we, it cannot go beyond our, you know, mind in a way. It's within our mind's experience. So therefore, you know, the mind and matter is very, you know, especially nowadays, you know, this the very modern science, you know what they call it? They have a very special name. What do they call it? This, it's a quantum, but it's a different, not...
String.
No, beyond that. they call it quantum... not digital, so the quantum... Not mechanics. Quantum... it's quantum, what we call it? This is the most modern...
quantum organics?
Not organics. Even what they call it? quantum... No. I forget now. It's a... Anyway, it doesn't matter. You find out that. There is something, quantum something. Yeah. What is it? That's what I'm not remembering. I'm getting old. Quantum... something to do with, I think, with the comic something. But it's, I mean, the word, you know. No. Quantum. Quantum what? It's supposed to be something more than quantum mechanics, you know. More science, you know, scientific kind of, you can call it discovery if you like. After, you can say, after quantum mechanics. It's very, very new, they say. Last 10 years or something like that. No scientist here?
Yeah.
What they call it? Genetic?
No.
Quantum what? Anyway. You just keep it in your mind. somebody will find it somewhere. Anyway, that's not your... and what... Oh, how do you determine that something is sentient? You know, when we say sentient, that means that somebody has the feeling and, you know, have some experience, you know, things like that. That's sentient. So, anybody who has that is essential, you know, like human beings, animals, you know. I don't know whether the flowers and the plants and these things they're living, but they're, whether they have essential or, I mean, they have a feeling or not, I don't know, you know. I think the Jains, you know, the Jains said they have. Buddhists, I think they say it could have, but not necessarily. I think so. Buddhists don't say, I think generally, or believe generally, that everything that that is living has, you can call mind, I mean, mind is not necessarily thinking mind, you know, but, you know, feeling, you know. Although we talk about, you know, beings or sentient beings with one kind of, you know, we have like five senses, six senses, with one sense, two sense, three sense, four sense, you know, like that, can be, you know, only can feel, only can, you know, do just one of them, but not all, you know, two of them. They say that there are different kind of beings like that, but there is no, it doesn't say that, you know, like to cut a flower is like killing an animal or something like that. Although Buddha said don't cut trees or don't cut, you know, grass and things like that, but it's not necessarily that they have. Also, I mean, that's another matter. Should I talk about that or not? Maybe not. You know, they talk about you know, the value of the life, you know, like the more like a human being, you know, you can see here and all these things, and you can have more capacity to enjoy life more, to have more, you know, is more valuable, more important. Like to cut that life is more worse than to cut the life of you know, like as something insect that lives only for one day or something like that. Now, this kind of things is there, but generally, but then from Buddhist point of view, it is usually said like this, that if I'm really, you know, if my mind is connected to something, you know, I could be that. Like if I think that, you know, this door is me, you know, if I really feel that this door is me, then I become this door, you know, like after you die. So then, you know, the door becomes a sentient being, kind of, you know. So if you bang the door, then I feel very bad, you know. So you should not bang the door. So they say that, you know, there's something in Bodhisattva Avatara, no? Is it in Bodhisattva Avatara? Gordon Kawa, Tabno Pata. The doors, the pillars, the oven, and the, you know, like ropes, yeah. People can be, you know, like associated with that, you know, because your mind can do anything, it's very creative. You know. So therefore, you cannot say that this is not sentient at all. It's difficult to say, you know, even like, door is not a living thing, you know, but still it can be sometimes. It's not that always, but so that's, you know, this is not very, you know, very clear. Now, Vibhashaka and Swatantrika, I'm not very sure about those things, but Rafi. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
So, we studied that the Vibhashika and the Satantrikas,
uh-huh,
their view of the Absolute is the same.
Uh-huh.
But, so we saw that the relative of the Satantrika is different and more profound than the Vibhashika, but what about the Absolute? Because we say that it's the same Absolute, matter and mind are small parts of it.
You know, this the way to define the what can you say? What can you say? The you know there is kind of when you talk about you know the ultimate reality, you know, like there's the what can you say the material kind of the basis of the creation, you can call it if you like, the partless particles and the basis of the mind, that is like what do you call it? You know, the partless, you call it, moment of consciousness. This, I think, the kind of same thing. There might be some differences. They're supposed to have some differences. Because there are two different schools, you know. Generally, I don't know whether because you know, Vasubandhu belonged to Swatantrika, so therefore he thought it was better. Or just it was better. I'm not very clear, you know, I don't really know exactly, but it's generally like Vyavasika and Swatantrika and things like that, it's put like that. And then, of course, I mean, there are also differences, I think, slight differences between the different, you know, masters on defining the things, but generally speaking, you know, Swatantrikas are like sutras, you know, based on sutra. They take the sutras, you know, sutras means generally the teachings of the Buddha. That's the first, you know, the first what you call it, first wheel of Dharma sutras, as the main, you know, source of you know, they really depend on the sutras, and then they kind of take that as the, you know, ultimate thing. So therefore they're called Swatantrikas. There are lots of logic. I mean, logic is maybe not the right word here, but Swatantrikas have developed a very strong way of you can call it reasoning if you like, you know, reasoning study, you know, thema, you know, pramana, and the Vyavasikas not so much. They say that whatever, you know, like the world says is the way it is from the relative point of view or something like that, you can say. And Swatantrikas have lots of, it's not just like whatever anybody says, you know, we have to establish, there's, you know, very strong, clear, you know, the, you know, the generally they're different views, they're slightly different views, but the Buddhist, you can call it logic, you know, pramana, is basically Swatantrika, you know. And then a little bit later on, you know, Chittamatra also quite strong, but basically Swatantrika, you know, the logic, Buddhist logic. So that's why I think it's considered a sign of a little bit above. And then? Too many questions on Chittamatra. Huh? Okay, Helen.
Yes. How would you explain to a general Buddhist public with little understanding of Buddhist philosophy the system of Chittamatra? And how can you help them understand that an object in front of you is mind only?
I think it's the way I explained just now. And that, I mean, citta matra, the main thing, you know, the main thing when you talk about citta matra is this, that, you know, it's really from that point of view is not totally different from Adhemic, I think. You know, you call it citta matra because in Svatantrika and below they say there is a, you know, there's a kind of material basis, you know, this, which is absolutely true. So in citta matra, that material kind of base, you know, that is totally existing on its own, is kind of cleared, and also a kind of a mind also kind of existing on its own, something, you know, truly existing. So this, you know, in the citta matra, the thing is that they worked on that, the material basis as it is existing on its own was cleared, but mind they didn't, at least from the Madhyamika point of view. I must say this because it is, I'm not 100% sure that if there were really citta matra philosophers now, how would they say? You know, there are lots of things that Madhyamikas put in the mouth of citta matras. You have to say this, you know. Then they so that they can defeat them. Maybe, but that's not my problem anyway. So that's the idea, you know. So they don't say that, you know, they don't say that there is nothing, you know. They say that they talk about what you call it, the, you know, we have these three things, three natures, the imputed nature, dependent, and then completely yamtu. I don't know how to completely established or whatever. Completely existence, yamtu. Existence, huh? Completely exist.
Absolute nature.
Yeah, that's better. Absolute nature. Yeah, absolute nature, dependent nature, and imputed nature. Now, you know, this so therefore they, you know, all these things that we experience is regarded as the imputed nature because, you know, its nature is not absolute. The way we see things, the way we, you know, all those is very much to do with, you know, how you look at and what you are and in what way you look and, you know, all these things. So therefore there is no, it is not something that is totally absolute, you know, totally, you know, true or totally, you know, this is the only way. So therefore the, you know, imputed nature is very, and that's why everything is, you can say everything is mind, but it is, you know, everything is the way we experience it through different reasons, mostly kind of, you can say, especially the samsaric way is very much the, it's a kind of, what can you say, it's something that is, it's not completely projection, you know. It's yeah. There are also different, slightly different views on, you know, the projection. You know, it's not complete. It's yeah, there's projection also, but not necessarily like only you project and there's nothing else. You know, there's some like you know, like half of the egg. You know, there's something other than that. You know, then there's a few different, you know, schools of the Chitta Matra also on how to, but all of them agree on one thing, is that, you know, it's a it's the kind of display of your experience, you know. So therefore the way you see things is, it totally don't, you know. Now because, you know, because the reason why they say this is because, you know, the matter, you know, what we call matter is also our experience. And you know, when we look at the matter, you can, you know, matter is made of what? Matter is made of, you know, five elements, and each of these elements, or each of these, you know, at like the smallest, you know, building blocks are made of what? You know, so it has, it can be, this, it's, it can go, you know, there is, you can't find, it is not possible that there is one small thing that cannot be divided. So, you know, it's divided, and then at the kind of, at last, it has to become something not solid. So therefore, it is not, you know, there is no material basis of the whole thing, which is ultimately true. When there is no material basis of something that's ultimately true, then how all this can come? So it is interdependent, but it is, you know, so therefore it has to be, it has to be, you know, that's why, you know, then we say that, you know, there can be a whole world on one at one speck of dust, you know, because the space and time is, you know, is interdependent, it's interrelated, it's relative. So therefore it is not necessary that, you know, you have to find a big space to have the big world, because, you know, since there is nothing, you know, the world is made of almost nothing, so therefore it is not necessary to have a big place. You know, the space is also relative, therefore. So therefore, therefore there is no, you know, it's not absolutely necessary to have, you know, there is no material basis. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So therefore, you know, Chitta Matra. Therefore, it's only an experience. It's only, you know, arises almost out of nothing when all the right conditions come. You know, so the it's a little bit like it's like imputed. It's like a magic show. But you know, that magic show, if you see it as, you know, if you grasp that, that's the samsara. And if you see that it is a magic show, it is relative, it is, you know, imputed, then it's nirvana. So therefore the ultimate nature is not something different from, you know, ultimate nature is to deeply see that experience is, you know, the way it is the way it's imputed. So therefore the independent nature is that, you know, this independent nature is connecting these two things. This, that the, you know, out of this, the clear light or clear, you know, the capacity to experience, you know, you call it alaya, you call it Buddha nature, you call it the mind, you call it whatever, that, because of this, that is the independent nature. And so, because of the dependent nature, then, you know, everything is, you know, arises. And because when you get hooked to that, then it is samsara. When you see its nature, then it's ultimate. So therefore, you know, it's that. And then that dependent nature, which is, you know, that's kind of more or less, they say, it's real. Mm-hmm. So that's why the Madhyamikas think that they really hold on to a strong, you know, sense of reality of the nature of mind. Mm-hmm. So they say that's very wrong. That's the kind of main allegation of the Madhyamikas, is that they think the mind is truly existing. Mm-hmm. They don't totally say like that. They say in a different way, but anyway, that's how they. Paloma?
Well, it seems like quite a big mental leap to understand that mind can only cognize something of the same nature as itself. That there needs to be a relationship of the same nature between mind and its object.
It seems to be quite a mental leap to understand that mind can only cognize something of the same nature as itself. That there needs to be a relationship of same nature between mind and its object. I begin to understand this. I think it is not, I don't think it is saying that. I think what they are saying by saying this, you know, that one can recognize the same nature. I think is that you know, mind, you know, everything that we experience is experienced by the mind. So it's the mind's, what can you say, experience. It cannot go beyond the mind's experience. I suspect it's talking about that, because there is lots of debate on that, and it's a little bit unclear, you know, to me. So I think it is saying, it's just saying that the, you know, because it is, you know, it is an experience of the mind. So therefore, it is something that is, you know, it cannot go beyond the, you know, it cannot go beyond the mind's limits, you can say, because all your experience, you know, when you talk about matter also, we are talking about an experience of the mind, not something else. Because nobody can, you know, say anything about anything which is not, you know, your experience. And if you are saying something about your experience, it's within your mind. So therefore, it is not possible for anybody to have any say about anything that is beyond your mind. Understand what I'm saying? I think they're talking about that. Is Esther?
Maybe I can ask Millie the second part of the question. I was wondering, we've already answered it already, but how come that if we have different mind streams and we still very coherently see the very same things, if there is no extra mental objects, or maybe there are, because the human beings say there are extra mental objects, but why everybody at any time comes into this room will see that these two windows painted in the same color, and there is, if the mind stream is distinct and it all comes from common karma?
That's what I'm saying, is that if, you know, anybody who is coming into this room is, you know, like, and seeing these two windows as, you know, painted red, are of the similar kind. Actually, this is the understanding from Buddhist point of view, that beings of the similar kind, that's called, we call realms, you know, can only able to see each other and can able to communicate with each other. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to see each other, you know. Like, there could be a being who is totally different from us, but then that being, we cannot communicate, we cannot see. So we cannot ask, what's the color of the window, you know. So therefore, you know, all of us are the same, you know, made in the same way, or the similar way. So therefore we, you know, we kind of, we see the same thing, we see the same color, of course, with different, slight different ways. You know. That's why this kind of common karma is I think that. And when we talk about common karma, you know, this that we all live in the same, you know, look at the same thing, look at the same, is because we are similar in many different ways, you know, like the way we, our brain is structured, the way our eyes are structured, the way our body is structured is same, so we can see all these different colors, and you know, we can see, we cannot go through the wall, and you know, we have to eat certain things, and you know, we need all this, you know, so our, the length of our eyes, the you know, the strength of our ears, you know, we cannot hear above certain or below certain beats of you know, voice, we cannot see above or below certain lights, you know, so we are very similar, no?
My question is, if the mind streams are distinct and we have seeds of karma in our mind stream, which make us see things as we see, is it really like we have really different seeds that make us see this thing in a similar way? Or, and it's distinct? Or we share, when we share common karma, do we share one seed for all of us? Or we have like multiplications of the same seeds in each one of us?
Seed.
Like the habitual tendency, the seed of the...
Yeah, that is... you know, in... in, you know, in the Hindus have this like Mahatma or Big Atma, you know, that they think that they say that the there's a big consciousness, and then so when our individual consciousnesses you know, come from that, and then when we kind of dissolve, we dissolve into that. So there is one big consciousness and we are small consciousnesses. Buddhists don't say like that. Buddhists don't say like that, that we are part of this big consciousness, because the consciousness is something, it's not something that is real. You know, that's also as what can you say? There's nothing there, you know, it's not something that this is my you know, consciousness, but this is part of that consciousness. So therefore it's just awareness. So therefore it's not something, it's not part of something, or it goes back to something, or it comes out of something. It's not like that, but that is awareness and consciousness. So therefore it's a like, you know, as long as you have this individual karmic thing, it's like that. But when you become enlightened also, it's same. You know, it's not that it has to dissolve into something different. But it can also become many, and it can become one, you know, like it can emanate. You know. So therefore it's not like, what can you say? It's not... the awareness is not is not like a concrete, what can you say, truly existing thing. So therefore, there's, you know, it's not something that, you know, that this is my consciousness, and, you know, it's nothing like that, but there can be. So therefore it is, that's why the emptiness is a little difficult to, you know, grasp in our mind, you know. But it's like that. So therefore it's not like, you know, what can you say? It can be an individual thing. You can say it is an individual thing, but it is not that, you know, it is something existing on its own. And?
Rinpoche, I think you answered the first one of these questions, or you addressed it about the Chitta Natra Sun truly existing one. And I just want to say I'm really happy you came today to visit us and teach us. I'm really happy about that, and also especially happy because I can ask this second question, which I keep asking all the time whenever the two truths come up. In fact, when you came to Larabling, I think 4 years ago maybe, we had discussion sessions in the evening time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried to win a discussion against Jeremy and Dominic Side about this. And Jeremy told me to, you know, when there's questions like this, to go home and think about it. And that was the best way to do it. So I thought about it a long time. And it's really honest that whenever we talk about the two truths, I always find it seems to be talking about a single thing, or one insight. And the one insight is like one insight about the way things are. So if we look at a table, or if we look at anything, it's just a single insight about suchness, or the way it actually is. Almost like you could call it the absolute relative rather than the absolute, just whatever you want to call it, but just suchness, and that that it's really just a single insight, it's not two truths, and that maybe, I don't know if the way to explain it is that two truths are like a provisional teaching or a way of directing our mind towards what is really a single kind of realization or a single insight about the way things are. So that's the point of view that I try to take and have been trying to take, that it's not really two truths but one truth is the right way. So, and anyway, so I don't know. I was told to debate the Buddha about this because it was taught as two truths. But I asked you.
No, I think Buddha didn't. I mean, this is the true truth is a presentation of presentation of how things can be perceived. You know, it's not about there's two truths. There's two ultimate truths, you know. So therefore, there's only one ultimate truth, but can be perceived, you know, and through that perception also. I think you, in a way, you are true. I think you are right. You are right. It is said also. I can't remember the exact quotation right now, but. It is said like that. Ultimately, there is only one truth. Ultimate truth. Yeah. Because when you see the relative, you know, this is what I think. You know, ultimate truth is nothing but seeing things as everything. You know, everything is relative. Relative means like, you know, it's very interdependent. And, you know, relative is, I think, the word you can say. So everything is really relative. You see it completely. That's the ultimate truth. Yeah. So therefore, you know, there's nothing called relative truth other than, you know. But, you know, when people talk about two truths, I think it's mainly to get rid of this, you know, like get rid of this misunderstanding. Sometimes, you know, you talk about the ultimate truth. You talk about the, you know, the emptiness nature. You take so much that you say, oh, there's everything is this, everything is, you know, kind of emptiness in its nature. There's nothing truly existing. So therefore, it doesn't matter whatever I do, you know. Then you become, you know, like you disregard the, like, karma, or, you know, how to behave with other people, and, you know, the compassion and things like that, and therefore then you go the wrong way. So therefore, you know, it becomes necessary, you know, at the beginning, to talk about these two truths. That, you know, ultimately it's like that, but, you know, that doesn't mean that you, you know, if you act in this way, you don't have that kind of result. So you have to be careful about the relative way of doing things also, you know. So therefore, I think it becomes, you know, your understanding of ultimate nature and meditating on it and seeing it becomes very important, but it also becomes important how you live your life and how you, you know, how you react with other people and how, what you do in the world, and, you know, how, what kind of actions you do, you know, is important. So therefore, it's you know, that's why I think two truths are taught, not that there is two things. Anything? Then? Yeah. Daniel?
We've seen that all the different Madhyamika schools share the same view of the absolute, but they differ in terms of the relative. And I don't understand how we can be a Sautrantika Madhyamika. In the way that after, when we are Madhyamika, when we arrive at the Madhyamika level, outer objects have been refuted. And I don't understand how can someone share the view of the Sautrantika and the Madhyamika.
You know, it's like this. Now, Svatantrika is, you know, like the sutras, you know, the teachings of the Buddha. This is like this, you know, the Buddha's teachings are all like this. That, you know, it's a little bit like graded, you know, this four schools kind of come later on, but it's also the same. It's, you know, different. It's like graded, you know. So what the first step, or the, you can call it lower if you like, but not really lower, but more, what can you say, the basic schools. The basic schools, what they say, you know, is not rejected by the upper one. It's only improved, you know. The basic things what is talked about is not, you know, like this is totally wrong, you know, it is something else, it's not like that. The most things are just accepted as it is, but then some things are, you know, refined, some things are kind of improved and things like that. That's why it is like that, you know. So therefore, you know, it's not that on that level, like, you know, there's the material basis, or that is, you know, that's gone deeper, and you can question, then, you know, you got to investigate and things like that. But then all other things are kept, you know, are accepted and not rejected. So I think that is how, you know, they go step by step. That's also why, you know, this it's necessary to study all others. Sometimes when you study just the Madhyamika, like philosophy on emptiness, then it seems that, you know, these other schools are just to be rejected. But I think generally, I think it should not be like that. You know, like there's the study of, you know, the most of the things that is actually like when you study the, you know, Abhidhamma Kosha, or when you study, you know, there are lots of things which is very common. There's nothing, you know, and then you go next step, and then, you know, some things are refined, and, you know, but then it's not, you know, everything else is similar kind of. I think it's like that, stepping by step. The Davida?
Yeah. I think the first part has been answered.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one is, you know, it is said that relative is the way things appear.
Mm-hmm.
The absolute is the thing they are. And I had some trouble with this definition, because it seems to say that the way things appear at the level of perception, you know, before I even think about it, is already kind of wrong, because it's the way the thing mm-hmm. appear, as if they're deceiving in the way they don't kind of manifest their actual mm-hmm. nature
mm-hmm.
when they appear. And I was wondering if this is
you know, relative is you know, when you talk about kunjot, the kunjot is not relative, actually, you know. Kunjot is
all-concealing.
All-concealing. No, no. Kunjot is more like kunjot. It's like we said in the three natures, imputed, you know. It's a little bit like that, you know. Kunjop. Kunjop means like jop means like wrong, you know, faulty. Kunjop is what can you say? Kunjop is like some people have translated also in that way. Kunjop is you know what kunjop is? Kunjop is like a farce, you know.
Like something that's misleading? Or?
Yeah, something that's just like
a masquerade.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah. Kunjop. Jop is so kun is all like not untrue, kind of, you know, unreal, untrue. So therefore, it's not about relative. It's about, you know. So then kunjop is, you know, then as it is seen by the subside, or and then dhanam is as it is. That's why it is said like this, I think. Of course, the kunjop and tandam, I think of course, tandam is also to, you know, the ultimate is to see that really, you know, everything is really relative. But to see that is tandam, you know. It's not, tandam is not something else. It's to seeing the how relative the things are, you know, is that the tandem. So therefore, you know, the tandem is not something other than that. But when you say, you know, kunjup is how you see, means how, and tandem is how it is kunjup is how, you know, the anything that manifests, whether it's real or not, especially if that's not as it is, that's kunjop, you know. If it is manifesting as it is, then it's a tanda, you know. No? So that's why consorting tandem is different like that, I think. But then, you know, this, when you talk about the two truths, this is also, as I said before, you know, I think the main reason why we have to talk about this too, is that this, you know, you have to, there are certain things that, especially when we are at the level of practicing and things like that, we have to, it's not ultimately true, but we have to be careful, you know, like, because if you just, you know, disregard everything that is, you know, relative, or that's not completely 100% ultimately true, that doesn't lead us to something too good. You know, it can be, it can be not so, you know, useful. Or it can be harmful to ourselves and others. So we have to be, we have to use this, you know, we have to understand at these two levels. Although ultimately everything is emptiness. Ultimately there's nothing to fear. Ultimately there's nothing to die. Ultimately, you know, there's nothing, you know. But then, relatively there is, you know. So therefore, you know, what we say, how we act to other people, what we do, you know, everything has an effect, and it's very important. Although it is not ultimate, but it is very important. So to see that. And Sarah?
Yes, the problem I've got seeing how the group is seeing the phenomena as separate to the true existence. So, for example, with the cup, how can I see that the cup exists and then on the other side its lack of existence is something separate? How can I can't kind of access that.
Well, this is, you know, I think this was like, you know, the Tsongkhapa made this way of, you know, teaching, you know, like he said that the cup is not empty, but the, you know, the exist, you know, the what with the true existence, or, you know, is another word. Anyway, it doesn't matter. You know, that the cup is truly existing, that's the problem, you know. So this is, I think, a way of, you know, way of teaching, you know, that, you know, it's not to say that there is no cup. It's not saying that there is no cup, you know. But it's like grasping at the cup as this really, you know, that becomes the problem, you know. Now, this, you know, I don't really know whether the Gelupas completely misunderstand that, or, you know, Nyingmapas put on that. This can be debated, but, you know, this, there is lots of debate on this, but I think it's a way of, you know, explaining. You know, when you try to explain something to some, you know, some people, you know, you try to kind of, you know, make it simple, and, you know, I think this is what he really wanted to, is that, you know, when you talk about the emptiness, it's not talking about that there's no, you know, the cup is not there. It's not. When you talk about emptiness, how cup is there? That's the idea, no? Of course, Nyingma Rinpoche said that if you say that cup is there, but the true existence of cup is not there, that wouldn't help me to have attachment to the cup, because there's no true existence of cup. He says that, but, you know, I think it's not necessarily saying like that, I think. And that's my feeling. I don't know. You know, you can debate with Gelugpa if you want. Because when you know, try to explain, you know, you try to make it simple, you know. I think it comes from that. But becomes, maybe later on, became too rigid on that, you know. Then, Roger?
Well, my question is a bit about this also. How does reasoning overcome the tendency to cling to the true existence of things? I can understand how reasoning can disprove invalid reasoning, so the imputed existence. But about for the innate or co-emergent clinging, how is it that reasoning is able to vanquish that?
Not completely, but it will help. You know, I mean, it's most of our reactions are, you know, like based on a reason, no? Or a kind of a, say, like, you know, when something happens, you know, or something, somebody says something to me that's not so nice, I get angry, you know. And I get angry because I think that is good, you know, like, not really good, but, you know, there's good reason to be that, you know. Somebody is trying to harm me, and if they're trying to harm me, then, you know, I must not, you know, I should feel bad, you know. There's kind of, you know, it's a training in a way, you know, it's the way of seeing. And so therefore, when I'm, you know, I'm justified to get angry and, you know, do something bad, or do something, say something in return, or do something that, you know, they will stop saying that. Whether I can do that or not is another question, but, you know. So when I have that way of seeing, you know, when, as long as I have that way of seeing, I will get angry, I will say bad things when somebody says and things like that. But then, when I really deeply understand that, you know, if somebody said something bad about me, there is no reason why I should get angry. You know, if I really understood that deeply, then I would not react angrily. No? So that understanding deeply, understanding is on the kind of, you can call it reasoning, but it's a reasoning, no? It's a, I see clearly that, you know, whether something happens this way or that way, you know, if I get angry or upset, it doesn't help me or help anybody else. Therefore, you know, it is much better if I don't get upset than if I get upset. Because if I get upset, it is not nice for me, it is not nice for anybody. But if I don't get upset, it's nice for me, it's nice, not nice for others. So therefore, it's absolutely the best way. And if I really deeply understand that, there's no reason for me to get angry, no? So it's like, you know, it's like an understanding, no? It's an understanding. So that, you know, is the example, you know, like, so if you really deeply, you know, see things clearly, you know, my reasoning is about seeing clearly, you know, why and how. So when I clearly see that this is like this, then that can really change my way of reacting, no? So that's why, you know, I think that the ignorance. Ignorance is that, you know, this ignorance is that, you know, I must react like this, I must understand, see like this. So when I really see clearly, this is not the way I should see, it's not the way I should react. This is, you know, there's no way, there's no reason to, then that is wisdom, you know. So therefore, when I really get the wisdom, you know, then the ignorance is gone, and that's why it completely changes my way of seeing, my way of reacting, my way of being. So therefore, you know, it has very important. So that this, you can call it reasoning, you can call it understanding, you can call it, you know, clarity, you know, whatever you call it. And, you know, it's kind of... and to get that, it is sometimes useful to think, you know. Because sometimes we react, because we have been reacting like this, or people, everybody around us is reacting like this, or, you know, so it's kind of, you know, kind of, I think that I should react this because everybody, I don't go deeply why, you know, it's really should be like that or not, you know. And then when you really deeply go into it and see clearly, it's not like that, or it should not be like that, or it's no use, then I have another insight. So that is, I think, called, you know, you can call it reasoning, or you can call it whatever, insight. And Christian?
I'm sorry, it's quite a specialized question about the use of the logical argument between Satantrika and Prasangika methods. So, what is the difference in the way both use the logical argument?
Usually it is said like this. Swatantrika Madhyamika philosophy, Swatantrika Madhyamika philosophy uses logic, you know, like a really logic way. Prasangika doesn't use as a reasoning. Prasangika uses only, you know, what can you say? To put others' logic on, you know, like to turn, what can you say, like, turn back, you know, like if you say, you know, this is like this, you say, if it's like this, then what about that kind of, you know, you kind of. So, prasangikas are not supposed to have any kind of, is any theory of their own, you know, like that's the prasangika's main understanding, the main, what can you say, main view, that I have no view, you know. If you have any view, it's wrong, you know. So therefore, you know, I'm free from any view. You know, I'm free from any kind of assertion. You know, so therefore, you know, I just ask questions about others' assertions, because every assertion is a wrong assertion. So that's the, you know, that's the way. Then, Dami.
Can you say a word on in what sense the skillful means of the Vajrayana are based on this understanding of the two truths from the sutra? Like,
it's this, I think it's the same thing. I mean, the Vajrayana is also very much based on, you know, this Sutrayana thing. And two truths is like, as I said, you know, like Guru Padma Sambhava said, that your view has to be, you know, he said something like that. Tava mangha linto, shirpa bhakshivishit, you know. Tawa namkalento is your view has to be higher than the sky, but your action has to be more minute than the flower, you know, this with which you make roti. So that minute means like you have to be very fine, you know. Fine means like very. You can say that. Yeah, you have to be careful about your actions. So this is, you know, the Vajrayana also based on that. That Shupa yinzi, Tava means it. Tava just come from there, and in Shepa you do like this. You know, so it's, you know, this has to be together. The, you know, the your actions cannot be, you cannot allow your actions to be too much carried away by your view. You know, and but your, you know, your views cannot be too much restricted by your actions. So it has to be, you know, together, mm-hmm. balance. So this is the two truths, and you know, I think is based on that. Mm-hmm. And then in the Vajrayana is basically, I mean, it's basically it's the, you know, the same. Same thing, only that there is more, you know, like more methods and, you know, skillful means in the practice to work on your habitual tendencies. That makes Vajrayana, you know, kind of a little bit special. Mm. And Vajrayana is supposed to be more experience oriented than intellectual oriented. So there's things like that. And then, Rob?
Rinpoche, the last question, you actually touched on it in the very first answer, in the very first question, so it's good combinations. And it's about, at the end of the 19th century in the West, in Western civilization, we had a number of very great thinkers in psychology and philosophy. For example, Sigmund Freud in psychology, and I mentioned Nietzsche in philosophy. And both of those are authors who I read a lot when I was younger, and especially Freud, who I read all of his works. And if you read all of Freud and you look at the situation with psychology today, you realize that something like 80% of it has been sort of refuted and sort of set aside. And in fact, Freud, when you read him, one of the things charming is he made so many mistakes. I mean, so many things he said were wrong. And Nietzsche was the same way, that was actually clinically insane by the time of the end of his life. So a lot of the works he wrote, mm-hmm. were kind of crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And is it yours? No.
I think so. We'll just at least close this. I hope. Can I answer?
Please, yeah. Yeah.
Hello. 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 So, hopefully, it doesn't matter. Yeah.
So back to the point is that, so both of these, in our tradition, in Western tradition, it's like, it's quite common, in fact, it's almost part of our tradition to refute and to disregard a lot of, and both of these are considered very great thinkers, for example, Freud and Nietzsche. And yet, when we think of their contemporaries in Tibetan tradition, like Nipam,
mm-hmm. I understand.
Already, you know what my question is,
yes.
Right? So my question, and actually, should we consider, I mean, everything that Dipam Rinpoche says as perfect and flawless? Or, as sometimes is the case with me, because maybe it's the way I am, I'll see something and I go, well, that doesn't seem quite right. Or, although he says this is a very good argument against this point, it doesn't look like such a perfect argument to mm-hmm. me. And 19th century thinkers like Thapto Rinpoche, for mm-hmm. example, even in the book that we all look at very carefully, says the words of my perfect teacher. So it's always talked about as a teacher being perfect. And so how should we understand this idea that our teacher is perfect, or that the words that, let's say, Nipam Rinpoche is saying are perfect, or that this last part was sort of added because we had a question once before about the Buddha's words being perfect also. So. But that's a sort of second part.
Mm-hmm.
Main things about the teacher.
I think it is like this, you know, the Buddha's, like all the Buddha's teachings, are not taken as absolute truth, you know. That means ask questions, you know. That means kind of. But it is not rejected, you know. It's a. I think that's the something very different from the way the Buddhist kind of Buddha formulated the teachings, and also later on, is that he made it into two categories, you know, Tangden and Ngedun. Tangden, how do you pronounce that? How do you translate that? Provisional teachings, or there are other words for it. I'm not totally happy with this provisional, but anyway, provisional teachings and then ultimate teachings, you know. So the provisional teachings can be, you know, something that was given for certain people, or, you know, for a certain reason. It's not necessarily has to be true all the time. So they can be, you know, they can be cast aside. Ultimate teachings are supposed to be the real, you know. Now, which is ultimate and which is provisional is not completely sure. So therefore it was defined later, you know. So that's why all these debates, you know, all these debates is about what is really true and what is not really true, and that's why also we talk about the two truths and things like that. So therefore, in Buddhism, it is not necessary that you have to reject anything that the great masters have said. You can put it aside if it is not really according. Of course, you can reject it also if you like, but, you know, you don't have to kind of you know, that's if you really, if it doesn't fit with the logic, then it is doesn't fit with the logic. That's another matter. But it is also possible that you know, the logic is you don't understand clearly. So that's also, there has been like that also, you know, like they said that this, you know, this is not good logic, and then somebody else came later on and says, no, you didn't understand it, you know, this was good logic, and, you know, that's why all these different debates are because of those things. So therefore, you know, it is like that. But I think it is very much possible, like His Holiness Dalai Lama was saying in the science, in the Mind and Life conference and elsewhere also. He was saying that, you know, this anything that doesn't really, you know, coming from the teachings of the Buddha doesn't really correspond with the facts, is not necessary to believe in that. You know, like he was saying about the Jiten Chasu, you know, this in the Abhidhamma Kosha, this, you know, the size of the moon and the sun and things like that. He says it's totally wrong. Whether it is said by Buddha or Ayadeva or Vasubandhu, whoever, doesn't matter, it's wrong. So it's like that. So it's, you know, so you can disregard it.
But should we regard the teachings of Abhidhamma Rinpoche as flawless teachings, or without, you know, as perfect? That's quite a gap between, like, the Western. That's a hard thing for someone coming from the West. It's a big difference between the Western approach.
I think first, this is the main approach from the Buddhist point of view. Is first, before you say that it's completely wrong, you really try to find out what it really means to say. You know, that's, you know. And if you really understand what it means to say, and then you really find that it's not right, then you say it's not right. Till then, you better not say it is not right too quickly. You know, that's the whole point, you know, because sometimes some of the things not easy to understand, you know. Not easy to understand, even the, like, the arguments and things like that. Even in Tibetan, you know, the translation is even more difficult. So therefore, you know, then it is, it's Of course, Mevang Rinpoche has been, you know, debated. You know, there's many, many people during his lifetime also, you know, sent what you call it, letters of what you call it, criticism, and then they debated. He answered to them, and you know, there are lots of debates. But you know, some people think that he is flawless. Mm-hmm. Some people think that maybe so, not so much. You know, that depends on, you know. So thank you very much. So we came to the end of the questions. So anyway, I'm very happy that to see you all, and you all look very good. And, I don't know how good study you're doing. It seems you are eating good food. And so thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah.